Our next case, come on up, counsel. Our next case is A18-1786, Thomas Rufinack versus Metropolitan Council, Metro Transit Division. Counsel, you'll each have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant, 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. So whenever you're ready, counsel, and have the podium. It goes up and down, as you no doubt know. Just state your name and the party you represent for the record.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Richard Wiley, and I represent the relator Thomas Rufinack. Mr. Rufinack was a bus driver for the MTC, and he was discharged from his employment last May. He grieved, asked to grieve his discharge. His union, called for short the ATU, filed a grievance. When initial steps failed to resolve the grievance, he asked that the union demand arbitration under a collective bargaining agreement in place, and the union refused. He then petitioned under Minnesota Statutes 179A.25, which I'll refer to more often than anyone wants to hear as the independent review statute, for independent review under the auspices of the Bureau of Mediation Services, the BMS. The BMS dismissed his petition for independent review, stating that because the union had declined or failed to ask for arbitration, he was not entitled to an independent review hearing. The statute, 179.25, says that it's the policy of the state of Minnesota that every public employee should be provided with the right of independent review by a disinterested person or agency of any grievance arising out of the interpretation or adherence to terms and conditions of employment. Then the statute directs that a review be conducted of statutes, ordinances, charter provisions, and the like to see if there is a provision for an independent, for a review of that type by a disinterested person or agency, or to look to see if the government employer, has provided for such or has offered such an independent review. If none can be found, then it's up to the employee. The employee then has the right to ask the BMS to conduct an independent review hearing.
Isn't the fundamental issue, Mr. Wiley, whether or not the process that is included in the collective bargaining agreement is the sole process here for the relator? I mean, your argument is because the union followed through with the first two steps but then opted not to pursue the grievance, that therefore, he did not have sufficient process, in essence, and therefore he gets kicked into the independent review statute.
Well, our position is that the we need to look at what the employer, the MTC, provides here. The MTC entered into the CBA with the union, and that CBA gives the right, the ownership of a grievance, to the union. We, all sides agree on that. It's up to the union to decide whether under the CBA, Mr. Rufinack, the employee, gets an arbitration of his agreement, of his discharge.
Right. So the employer has agreed to submit employment disputes to arbitration, and the union, on behalf of its represented employees, and part of that CBA, agreed that it had that their part of that is okay. Yeah, the employer will agree to submit to arbitration, but we get to vote whether to submit to arbitration or not. I mean, the employer is agreeing to submit to arbitration. It's just that the union chose not to pursue it in this case.
That's true enough, but looking at it from the top, it's the employer, in this case the MTC, which has also agreed that it's the union that gets to decide whether each step of the grievance procedure is invoked, including arbitration. So the employer can be said to have agreed to arbitration if the union asks for it, but it has not agreed to go to arbitration if the employee asks for it. And it's the employee asking for it that is significant here.
He wasn't initially asking for it. He was following along with the terms of the collective bargaining agreement that MTC had with the union. And it was at this final step that, you know, that things broke down. And so doesn't Mr. Rufinock then have potential legal action against his union for a breach of that agreement?
He does.
As opposed to trying to, you know, take this matter into a statute that doesn't seem to have been designed by its plain language for this use?
Well, I agree that it wasn't designed for this. I don't know that it seems to me that the design or the overall scheme of the statute is to provide possibilities for independent review. And I mean that generically, in the sense that somebody who's disinterested and doesn't know anything about it will look at the records, will hear testimony, will allow cross-examination, some due process rights in connection with the discharge. And I think that the scheme of the statute is to allow it to happen. And if it doesn't,
by extension, had they had an arbitration here, had the union taken this grievance through arbitration and they got an outcome that Mr. Rufinock was unhappy with, are you then claiming that under 2.5 he would have had some right to independent review because that would have been independent?
If the union had taken it to arbitration and lost?
Right.
No, I don't claim that he would have had 179A.25 rights beyond that.
Your argument is that right exists as long as the union doesn't go to arbitration, and that's because, I guess, the government agency should not have then entered into an agreement that gives that authority in the collective bargaining agreement to the union. Is that sort of... when they give that authority in that agreement that they also are committing to give employee-by-employee review?
I guess I'm agnostic or neutral as to what the employer should have done in its CBA. If it wanted to give the union the power to put a brick wall in front of arbitration, I guess it can do that if that's the best deal or only deal or whatever deal it wanted to make.
But then it has to have this independent.
But then it has to provide something else. Consistent with the policy of the state of Minnesota that every employee, not just those favored by unions, are entitled to independent review.
There's an argument in the briefs that effectively this should be addressed as a waiver issue, a waiver of arbitration, and that it was done by the union on behalf of the employee as part of their relationship. Can you address that question? Was it not waived? And therefore, there was an opportunity for independent review was simply waived.
I think to argue that there was a waiver is to argue essentially that there was a waiver of a constitutional right as well. the constitutional right to a post-termination hearing on his discharge. And I'll belabor it just a little bit, but since Loudermill and cases mentioned in the brief, an employee is entitled to boast both a pre-termination hearing, which really doesn't have to be much, and a post-termination hearing, which has been described in the most of its federal law, in the Eighth Circuit as a hearing with heightened procedural requirements. And it can't be said that there was a waiver of that right or a waiver of the statutory right. Now, I understand the thrust of the respondent's argument is that there was a procedure offered or a process offered that may have been waived, or that the process has a built-in potential for waiver, or it has a built-in potential that an actual hearing might not happen. And I don't know that my client, and I also further understand that the argument is that as Mr. Rufinak's exclusive representative, the union has the right to act on his behalf to avoid or cause an arbitration hearing not to happen. And what, in addition to the constitutional arguments,
but let me ask you, you said it can't be a waiver of a constitutional right. Why can't it be? Are you arguing it can't be because the union can't do it on his behalf, or there was something else that was insufficient to make it a waiver of that? Clearly,
first of all, the constitutional right belongs to Mr. Rufinak.
So you're saying the union can't do it?
They can't do it.
Okay, that's what makes it impossible in your view.
That's what makes it impossible in my view.
I see. Okay.
Number two, I don't think there's anything about what the union did or the company did, or the MTC did, to suggest that it was requiring or soliciting or offering or whatever a waiver of a constitutional right. If anything, the only thing they were doing was deciding not to take it to arbitration.
If that's
what happened here, and if that's okay, then Mr. Rufinak has not had yet a post-termination hearing, which the 14th Amendment, I think, entitles him to.
This constitutional issue was not brought forward to BMS, was it?
Well, the only thing brought forward to BMS was a request for a hearing.
Right. So, I mean, this was not raised independently. It was independent review was the thrust of it, and they said no jurisdiction.
The request for independent review was brought purely under the statute. Now, I do want to note that there has not been much by way of judicial interpretation of this statute under these or any circumstances. But the Sampson and the Klosterbuehr, I guess, cases suggest that Mr. Rufinak is correct here. The Sampson case versus City of Babbitt looked to see whether there was a independent review process or procedure in place when a city started a declaratory judgment action after the employee requested an independent review hearing. This court said that there wasn't, because we look at the time that the request was made, and at that time there was no procedure in place. The Klosterbuehr case, I think, was erroneously discussed in one of the respondents' briefs, but that case clearly said that where a union failed to request a arbitration or withdrew a grievance, that the employee's options were to sue that union or request an independent review hearing under 179A.25. When one reads that case, you need to read it three times, slowly. There's a long paragraph that describes what went on, and I think that's clearly what happened. And that case seems to say that we're right here and that the BMS should grant him a hearing.
You'll have time for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Dan Abelson. I'm representing Respondent Metropolitan Council in this matter. Mr. Rufinack has no right to review under Section 179A.25 for two primary reasons. The first is under PELRA, the review of grievances under collective bargaining agreement are governed by Section 179A.20, Subdivision 4, not 179A.25. And second, even if you look at 179A.25, Mr. Rufinack had a procedure for review under the collective bargaining agreement. The fact that his exclusive representative decided not to advance that to arbitration doesn't mean that the procedure didn't exist. I want to point the court just to two factual issues. The first is that there's nothing unique about the collective bargaining agreement in this case. So Relators Council talked about how maybe the collective bargaining agreement could have been different, or it gave the right to the union as opposed to the employee to seek arbitration. The collective bargaining agreement here is essentially the same as other collective bargaining agreements, and a decision here would have statewide impact.
Are your two reasons that you gave, they're independent reasons? You're saying that 179A.25 just simply doesn't apply in the context of a...
It's simple. I would say that they're, in a sense, they're alternate. I mean, it simply doesn't apply under the structure of PELRA. I mean, that's real. If you look at it as a whole, it doesn't apply, and you can get there a couple of ways. One way you get there is that PELRA has a completely separate scheme for when there's a collective bargaining agreement. So that scheme is, the statute says the collective bargaining agreement must have a right, a procedure for arbitration. And if it doesn't, then there is review under not 179A.25, but under 179A.04 and Minnesota Rule 5510. 179A.25 has a whole different scheme.
So you don't need to depend on the idea of waiver to make that argument.
No.
That's the question.
No, you don't need to depend on waiver. And I think the second piece, though, is, when you look at 179A, it talks about whether there's a procedure for review, and I think you can read all of PELRA consistently that there was a procedure for review, and it's that other piece, the arbitration. And the key in this is, of course, looking at the policies behind PELRA. So 179A.01 lists the policies of the entire act, and one of the fundamental policies is to resolve grievances and disputes between the employee and the employer in an expeditious way, because they're harmful not just to the employee and the employer, but to the public. And if you have these two competing rights of review, you don't have that. Another key point, when you're looking at what should apply here, is that the substantive right. Mr. Rufinack had a substantive right not to be discharged except for just cause. And that right exists in his collective bargaining agreement. So to determine whether he was denied that right, that should be under the procedure in the collective bargaining agreement. If you do it under independent review, 179A25. Now you're applying a different procedure to look at the substantive right, and not just that. Now you've got the Bureau under separate rules determining what's just cause. The union is not necessarily a party to the independent review, and the Bureau is now interpreting a contract between the union and the employer, potentially without the union as a party. And again, that can't be what the legislature intended. And, you know, as the Bureau points out in its brief, PELRA was enacted in 1971. Both of these statutes were there in 1971 in essentially the same form. So we have to presume that the legislature intended that they work together. When we look at the case law on 179.825 does, it starts with that broad statement. However, that's not how this court or the Minnesota Supreme Court have interpreted the statute. In Alexandria, this court, and in Bow, the Minnesota Supreme Court says it doesn't apply to at-will employees. And then if we look at the text of the statute, we see there's another very large group of employees it doesn't apply to, which is employees that have review under some other procedure. I'd submit that includes collective bargaining agreements, certainly civil service. For state employees, there's certain statutory procedures for employees that are not in unions. So this really is a narrow statute and applies to a relatively small group of government employees. I think the amicus point out that if this court were to read the statute so that it would apply when the union chooses not to take a case to arbitration, now it's applying to huge numbers of state employees and municipal employees, because the majority of government employees are not are either at will or governed by civil service or a collective bargaining agreement. So this would be a wholesale change in the law. I want to touch just briefly on why due process is not at issue here. First, you know, the 179.25 was not, you know, enacted as a response to Loudermill to provide, you know, some kind of hearing that the legislature thought was missing, right? 178.25 or its predecessor was enacted in 1971. Loudermill didn't come until later. So we can't presume that that's the reason that we have the statute. Second, as the court has pointed out, the due process issue was not raised below. The issue in this case isn't a due process one.
Is that something that the BMS would have authority to even address, though?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and that's another reason why I shouldn't. This is a case of statutory interpretation. Does BMS have jurisdiction or don't they? If they do have jurisdiction, then Mr. Rufinack will get plenty of process on remand. It's a full-blown arbitration process under 7315. If they don't have jurisdiction, then he's free to pursue any due process claim that he might have, the same way he's pursuing his breach of the duty of fair representation claim in district court. I just want to touch a little bit on the nature of the union's duty, I think, which is key when you're thinking about not a case not going to arbitration. The union can't simply decide, I don't feel like it's going to be too expensive to go to arbitration. The union, in exchange for the great power that it has in representing employees, has duties to fairly represent its members as the exclusive representative. And this duty is a fiduciary duty, which is, you know, the highest standard owed by law. So in rare cases, the union can make that decision that they don't think the claim has merit and not take it to arbitration. But when they do that, they face the risk of the breach of duty of fair representation claim, which is exactly what happened here. And Mr. Rufinack is free to litigate that claim. What's important in that case law, though, is it talks about the role of the employer, too. The employer is entitled to rely on the union's decision not to arbitrate, the same as if an employee who's not represented decides not to arbitrate. And if there's a review under 179A25, that Minnesota Supreme Court and U.S. Supreme Court case law, I think, goes out the window, because now there's this separate right. And I think, I know counsel answered that, you know, he's not making the argument that if Mr. Rufinack arbitrated this case and he was unhappy with the results of the case, that he could then seek independent review. And I appreciate that he's not making that argument, but I think if you rule in his favor, somebody will make that argument. Because if the idea is that the employee is not bound by what the union's decision in arbitration, not to arbitrate, because the union has control over that process, not the employee, post-arbitration, when an employee is unhappy, I don't know that their argument is that different. The argument is, my union didn't arbitrate this case the way I wanted them to. They didn't call the witnesses I told them to call. They didn't do what I said they should do because they had control, not me. I should get a right to review under 179A25. And again, I think that would be completely contrary to PELRA. And I want to touch on the argument, too, about the...
I don't know, frankly, that we'd really get there, because the statute is about independent review. I mean, that might be a complaint about representation, but it seems like a stretch to say that would be the next logical conclusion.
Well, I think somebody might argue it. But then this goes again to that's why we have the duty of fair representation and the hybrid action for the breach of duty of fair representation. You know, it's not all that different than, you know, as a lawyer, if my client, if I waive something on behalf of my client, if I choose not to make an argument because I owe competing duties, I owe a duty to my client, but I owe a duty to the court not to violate Rule 11, not to make an argument without merit. So if I don't make an argument, if I waive something on behalf of my client can then sue me. But it doesn't mean that they would get a do-over in the underlying action. Now, actually, they get a little bit more with the breach of duty of fair representation, because if the employee can prove that, then they get to litigate the underlying action against the employee as a breach of contract in district court. And I just want to touch very briefly on...
Is that what happens? I don't know that much. So if you prevail on a breach of fiduciary duty, you actually try the substantive... No, what do you...
Yes, and so this is in the Allen case. So you sue both the employer and the union, which in the complaint, in this case, the district court complaint is in the record.
Mm-hmm.
Though the case law says if you prove you have to prove the breach of the duty of fair representation claim first,
right,
then you get to go to the breach of contract claim.
Which is decided then in the district court.
It would be decided in the district court. Now, the employer maybe would have some arguments that should somehow be arbitrated, but it has to be, the underlying claim is decided. I just want to touch very briefly on the unpublished cases. I think that the Klosterbuehr case is the perfect example of why courts don't rely on unpublished cases. It's a case that I think was written... Unpublished, correct. It was a case that was written for the parties. You can't quite figure out what exactly happened there factually, but I think one thing is clear, that this court in that unpublished case did not decide the 179A25 issue. That issue was decided by the district court, and the employee decided not to appeal that issue, and the appeal was on his constitutional challenge, which was dismissed for jurisdictional reasons. In conclusion, Mr. Rufinack has no right to review here because under PELRA, grievances are covered by Section 179A20 and the terms of the collective bargaining agreement. And his procedural right to review under that need to occur under the collective bargaining agreement, which contains Mr. Rufinack's substantive right. Accordingly, the council respectfully requests that this court affirm the Bureau's dismissal of Mr. Rufinack's petition for independent review. Thank you.
Thank you. In rebuttal?
Thank you. That a decision by this court reversing the BMS would somehow change the fate of the Western world or the upset the labor management relations of public employees, I think, is vastly overstated. First of all, there's no indication from any of the parties or the amicus as to the extent how often this comes up. How often has the BMS been asked to provide an independent review hearing after a union has declined to arbitrate under a CBA? So I think that's vastly overstated. As I understand it, the two issues of statutory interpretation raised today are that 179A.20 mandates a decision that the union somehow has the right to foreclose forever an independent review hearing. And I don't think that's not what it says. It says that the parties to a public employee labor agreement should include a grievance procedure, or if they don't, one adopted by the a template, so to speak, provided by the BMS and its rules or regulations can be followed. What the BMS proposes is no different than the CBA. It's very limited. The union has the power over the grievance. And I think it all misses the point, which is that it's the individual employees who are entitled to independent review of, in this case, a discharge. And if that independent review is not actually provided, not that there's a process for it, not that it might be provided, but that it be provided, that's when the procedure under the BMS is triggered.
And your strongest authority for that proposition is Kloster Boer?
Well, that's certainly that's the only authority I could find. Mm-hmm. And Sampson is what it is. It focuses on the moment that the petition of the BMS is filed. At that point, you look around to see if there's anything else available. And in this case, the answer under Sampson is no, there wasn't anything else available.
Sampson didn't have a collective bargaining agreement, though.
They did not, but Kloster Boer did.
Right.
And again, I think one needs to read Kloster Boer closely, but I think it's pretty clear that the what was said about the employees' options after the union withdrew a grievance that it had filed, that one option was the independent review statute. There was a mention of the Ross case, which unfortunately was my case, and that was a case that determined that Ms. Ross did not have, she was an at-will employee, that the terms of various policies and so forth didn't meet the old Pine River standards. There's an argument or suggestion here that the substantive rights of not being of discharge, in this case, you can't be discharged unless the employer has good cause, come from the CBA, and therefore that, I guess, I assume, and therefore that right involves the union's right not to pursue a grievance for you or arbitration for you. I think they're separable, because 179A.25 talks about a hearing or review, disinterested review, which is a remedy. And
so your argument is the statute lets you separate procedure from the substance.
From the substance, okay. Exactly.
Great. Thank you. The case is submitted, and we'll have a decision out within the statutory time frame. We have a brief recess now while we set up ITV for the next argument. Thank you both.
All rise.
Yeah.